NBC Monitor News on the Hour, Jack O'Rourke reporting. The U.S. Pacific Military Command says American B-52s and tactical aircraft were involved in bombing runs over Cambodia today for the 40th straight day. The command would not say if the action was in support of a South Vietnamese move into Cambodia, where fighting is reported at two points along the border, at least a half mile inside Cambodia. The South Vietnamese government says the action is defensive in nature, designed to drive back communist forces of North Vietnam and Cambodia. The American bombing action will be the subject of a Senate Judiciary Subcommittee, which opens hearings tomorrow in Washington. Senator Edward Kennedy says it's now time to end the bombing runs and send diplomats to arrange a ceasefire in Cambodia. Bombing action today within 15 miles of Phnom Penh kept communist forces away long enough to allow eight cargo ships to reach that embattled city with food, fuel, and war supplies. Exiled Prince Sihanouk of Cambodia has accused American General Alexander Haig of planning a two-front invasion of his country using troops from South Vietnam and Thailand. General Haig returned from Indochina Friday after evaluating the Cambodian situation for President Nixon. Sihanouk heads a Peking-based royal government of Cambodia, and his statement was made in a speech in North Korea. Sihanouk, ousted in March of 1970, says he will return to power in Cambodia as soon as communist forces capture Phnom Penh. A list of military bases to be closed or cut back in an economy move will be sent from the Pentagon to Congress tomorrow. The move is designed to save up to $1 billion a year and do away with tens of thousands of jobs. Reports say the cutbacks, the first in more than 3 years, have been in the works for some time, but because of the political sensitivity of the move, the announcement has been put off. Reports circulating through Washington say New England will be hard hit, especially in Massachusetts, where severe cuts or closings are planned for the Boston Navy Yard, Westover Air Force Base near Springfield, and Otis Air Force Base on Cape Cod. In New Jersey, historic Fort Dix, where basic training was taken by millions of soldiers, also slated to be closed. Another killing in Belfast, Northern Ireland, by gunmen firing from a speeding automobile. A woman was shot and killed while inside her home in the Protestant sector. Last night, a man was killed in the same manner. And today, the British Army apologized for wounding a teenage boy and a sister in a confrontation with a sniper. Troubles in Northern Ireland have been blamed on the IRA. A report on that controversial group from Don Snyder in Belfast.
The Irish Republican Army is one of the ugly products of Ireland's tragic history, a history tortured by violence, religious war between Protestant and Catholic, the War of Independence and the birth of the Irish Republic, and the present battle for more democracy in Northern Ireland. The Irish Republican Army has two aims, to get the British out of Northern Ireland and to protect the Catholics against the Protestant majority. The British hold on the province, however, is stronger than ever. And the Catholics they are supposed to protect are becoming alienated by IRA terror. The violence of the IRA has blunted its political aims, made violence an end, and the irrational the hallmark of the movement. Equally important, terror has sullied its public image. The IRA now represents the uncontrollable passions spawned by the bitter Irish Catholic experience, and has drifted further away from the passionate pleas of moderate Catholics for peace. Don Snyder, NBC News, Belfast.
President Nixon plans a grand tour of Europe this fall. The White House says he'll probably visit Great Britain, France, Italy, and Germany, returning visits by leaders of those countries to the United States. The exact dates of the trip were not announced. Today, the president took advantage of beautiful spring weather in the east to cruise the Potomac River on the presidential yacht Sequoia. The death toll in yesterday's earthquake in Costa Rica has gone to 16. Rescue workers say it will eventually reach 50. While damage to city areas has been relatively light, major damage has hit rural areas where the quake hit with greater intensity than the earthquake of Nicaragua. Costa Rican President Jose Figueres has surveyed the damage by helicopter, and he says most damage was caused by landslides.
The real thing was landslides provoked by the shake, because the earth is very sandy. And the mountains are sandy and not clay. When they have clay, they slide down in heavy rain. But but in a dry time like now, anything that shakes hard enough causes a small landslide. And this is what buried a few houses.
President Fogarty says two entire villages have been evacuated because homes are in danger of collapse. Taxes and politics apparently don't go together, especially around tax filing time. The Internal Revenue Service says the plan to finance presidential elections with a tax checkoff plan has just not been successful. According to IRS figures, less than 3% of the taxpayers are signing a special form, setting aside a dollar of their taxes for the presidential race of 1976. The hour's lead story, American B-52s have continued their bombing runs over Cambodia for the 40th straight day. Jack O'Rourke, NBC News.
This is Monitor, immersing ourselves tonight in the wonderful sounds of the big band days. One top outfit that's been on the scene for many years is led by vibraharpist Lionel Hampton. And here's a good illustration of his easy swinging style, Rockin' in Rhythm. Monitor 73, the big band swing again. Leapfrog, Les Brown and his band of renown. Kicking off this last part of our Monitor special, the big band swing again, part two. In our final hour, we'll be hearing the music of some of the big bands who are still active today. We've already heard from Benny Goodman, Vincent Lopez, Duke Ellington, and we can add the names of Count Basie, Buddy Rich, Art Mooney, Woody Herman, and Stan Kenton, all of whom we'll be checking in with between now and the end of the show. Others still doing business include Harry James and Mr. Auld Lang Syne himself, Guy Lombardo. But right now, let's get back to Les Brown, who's alive, well, and living in California. This is another of those popular treatments of classical music, and it was a big one for Les. Thank you. Bizet has his day. Les Brown, whose orchestra was a longtime favorite of Bob Hope for his service tours and TV specials. Another big band that's still on the scene is led by Art Mooney, who recently concluded an engagement in New York City. And one of the remarkable things about Art's orchestra is that it's been an incubator for so much talent. So let's meet Art Mooney and get him to do a little name dropping. But first, Art, tell us about that tremendous hit that you had in the 50s with I'm Looking Over a Four-Leaf Clover.
To make a long story short, I heard the Philadelphia Mummers Band one New Year's Day, and I heard this real happy, corny, but a real happy sound with the banjos and saxophones and the mummers marching and dancing, and they were doing a song called I'm Looking Over a Four-Leaf Clover. So at this particular time, we just signed a recording contract with MGM Records, and we were very fortunate because we came and organized our band at towards the end of the big band era. We were one of the last bands to, as far as making hit records goes, and we started the sing-along with Four Leaf Clover just as a gag. As a matter of fact, Art, we were looking for a banjo player, and we couldn't find a banjo player in town, so we called up Paul Wypen at his farm over in Jersey and asked him if we could borrow his banjoist, little Mike Pingator. Yeah. And he said, fine. He says, go ahead. What's the name of the song you're going to record? And I said, I'm afraid to tell you because you may run in and record it. He laughed and he let us use Mike Pingator. And as a gag, like I said, it sold over 2 million records in about 30 days.
Now, of course, in those days, that was a fantastic amount of records because the record-buying public wasn't as big. The variety of methods of merchandising records weren't as diverse, and that was the equivalent of about 4 or 5 million today.
That's right, and in fact, I would say it started the sing-along because we came right back about 3 months later with a tune called Babyface, and that went over 1 million records.
Now, one of the things you did was very quietly, without anybody really noticing it at the time, Art Mooney was able to find more people who had great talent for singing and hire them for his band than anybody else around. And you never got full credit for that. Unless I'm mistaken, Al Martino started with you as a band singer.
That's right. Al was from Philadelphia.
He made one record, I think, and then you picked him up?
No. He was with the band before.
Before
he
the
made
record.
The record.
You really found him.
That's right. And we had a girl singer on the bandstand at the Lincoln Hotel. I could never think of her name. Every time we'd go on the air, her name was Florence. And to this day, I can't even think of her last name. So we gave her the name. We gave her the name Jane Morgan.
That's a funny story. You know, Jane Morgan went, I think, from your band to Paris.
That's right.
And became established as an international chanteuse and got a reputation in France. And then came back here to become a kind of a superstar
That's
in her
right.
own way. But she started with you.
That's true. At the Lincoln Hotel. And also, we had four boys from Boston. We auditioned them one afternoon and told them to start with the band the next day. And that happened to be the Ames Brothers. They were on the bandstand at the same time.
Pretty good for one band. I might add also that one of your first singers was a girl I found in the Bronx named Fran Wolf. And I couldn't buy the name Wolf for a pretty girl because it sounded like she was a man after girls. So I changed it to a girl's name, Fran Warren. And Fran Warren started with your band.
That's right, the Carmen. She was the first girl singer we had with the band.
And she was a great singer.
She sure was. And still sings great, too, Fran.
She's a fine singer.
And also, Art, the trumpet player, when we recorded Four Leaf Clover, he took the first recording to a disc jockey in Boston by the name of Bob Clayton.
Yes.
I think Bob Clayton.
He broke that record, I remember.
In Boston. And the trumpet player happened to be Danny Davis, who now has Nashville Brass. He was a trumpet player with our band.
I remember your vitality. And it took a lot of energy to be a band leader in those days. You had to be on the stand there. You had to kind of spark your men. You had to stand up and go through the night and travel. Would you say that keeping in physical shape is part of being a band leader who managed to survive the whole era?
Well, luckily, we have a home down in Hollywood, Florida. And when I get a chance, I usually go back there for 2 or 3 months, just relax, play some golf, go swimming, and then go back out on the road. Like, we play the riverboat here in New York City about 3 times a year. And we just closed Roseland Ballroom in New York City, and now we'll go back out on the road again for about 3 or 4 weeks of one-nighters.
I think that four-leaf clover brought you luck, because you're still riding high, Art Mooney. Awfully nice for you to take time out to join us on Monitor.
Thank you, Art.
Thank you.
Chinese Orchestra and their very big hit, I'm Looking Over a Four-Leaf Clover. Well, we'll meet and talk with another of the durable gentlemen of music who have continued their career right up to the present day. Mr. Woody Herman is the man, so stay with us. You're on the Monitor Beacon. Monitor 73 with Big Band Swing Again Part 2. The most successful musical organizations of the big band era was known as the Band That Plays the Blues. And the man in front was the old woodchopper himself, Woody Herman. Woody was one of the big names in jazz in the late 30s, 40s, 50s, and 60s, and yes, sir, he's still swinging right now in the 70s. How does he do it? I don't know. But I know he's been doing it for a long time, singing and dancing in local Milwaukee theaters at the age of six, playing the saxophone professionally when he was nine, and he's still rolling on today. Now, there must be some kind of secret formula for sustaining that kind of energy and talent so long. We'll find out all about it right after we hear Woody Herman and his orchestra play Goosey Gander. Thank you. Woody Herman and his band with Goosey Gander. Well, Woody, welcome to our monitor microphone.
Thank you. It's very nice to be here, Art.
How do you account for that enthusiasm and that energy for music all of these years?
Well, I think it's just force of habit that they wound me up many years ago, and I've failed to run down completely. I have to pump myself up every morning to get enough energy going, but it works out.
Well, the band sounds great today, just as it always did. And your theme song, let's see, years ago was, I presume it still is, Blue Flame.
Yes, indeed.
But everybody identifies you with Woodchopper's Ball. Are you tired of Woodchopper's Ball by this time?
Well, I don't think we ever get tired of anything that's kept us alive and kicking down through the ages. And certainly Woodchopper's Ball is by far and away the most closely associated tune with our band.
They call the Woody Herman Band the Herd. And the current herd, which one is it? They used to give it numbers, and still do, I guess. It's composed of an entirely new now-generation set of musicians, except for you, young men with mod clothes and shoulder-length hair. Is there any special reason for that new look to the boys?
Well, I think all of America has changed, and consequently it's certainly prevalent among the young jazz musicians. And as far as the youth of the band, all of my bands were always very youthful, mostly people in their early and mid-20s and early 30s, and sometimes a 40-ish one. It's just that I got old in the process of having young bands.
Well, Woody doesn't look at all old, as a matter of fact. Some of the great musicians that worked with you, Pete Candoli, go down the list just to bring back some of those great names for
Well, of course, there was his brother Condi, Chubby Jackson, the late Dave Tough, Flip Phillips on tenor, Bill Harris, trombone, and, of course, later, people like Stan Getz and Zoot Sims, and, oh, I could go on and on.
What about the vocalists with the Woody Herman Band over the years, besides Woody himself, who could sing the blues and still can, but who were the people that you were proudest of?
Well, I think there were two girls who were certainly terribly important to the band. One, very early, was Marianne McCall, and then later on, Frances Wayne.
Oh, yes.
And she is now Mrs. Neil Hefty, and, of course, the other young lady is out in California having a successful nightclub.
I know the Woody Herman Band is a very famous band in Europe today as it was 20 years ago. Do you get over very often, Woody?
We try to make it yearly and usually do. This coming fall season, we'll be doing the Isle of Man for a jazz festival. That's the first week in September. And then we'll be going on to England for approximately 2 weeks. Then we come back to the States, and then in November we go back and tour Europe, mainly Italy, France, and Germany.
How do you rank the current crop of musicians as compared to the old-timers in the field of jazz?
Well, I think today, of course, mainly due to the fantastic strides that musical education has made in the last 25 years, that young people today are so much better equipped than we were back in the dark ages. And I can truthfully give a big salute to all the music educators in America.
You're working with school and college music groups today. How's that going, and how broad is your contact with these young people on the campus?
Well, we do a great amount of clinics and seminars, and we visit high schools, junior colleges, and colleges, and work with the music students themselves, and along with the educators, and I find it some of the most gratifying and most enjoyable hours I've ever spent. Last year, I think we spent a good fourth of our year visiting schools.
In other words, despite the popularity of rock, there's plenty of room in the heart of young people today for big band jazz?
We have in the neighborhood of somewhere, in the neighborhood, I should say, of about 25 to 35,000 stage bands in high schools alone, and probably an equal amount in colleges and junior colleges. And when you take into consideration the fact that a stage band is nothing more than a big band, it's a brass section, a saxophone section, a rhythm section, and they are playing the charts and the music of Basie, Ellington, Kenton, and our band, and some of the others. And so there's a big segment of youth involved in big band music today.
Just for a second, looking back over the years, what were the engagements that stand out in your mind sentimentally as the most memorable?
Well, of course, I think probably the most sentimental one was the night that our daughter was born. We were on the stand at the Palladium, And we were about to go on to a network broadcast, and instead of theme, out came a tune called Daddy. And I mentally fired the whole band until the realization hit me that I was a proud new dad.
That's kind of cute. Woody Herman, thank you so much for joining us tonight on Monitor. Without you, it wouldn't be the Big Bands Part 2.
Thank you.
Woodchopper's Ball, Woody Herman and his fine orchestra. More of the swinging sounds of the big bands ahead. This is your host, Art Ford, inviting you to stay tuned to Monitor.
This is Traffic Commissioner Ted Carragizif. When you're shopping, do the best bargains often seem to be in the stores across the street? If you cross in the middle of the block to get to them, you may be buying grief. Crossing mid-block is the biggest single cause of pedestrian casualties. Don't go shopping for an accident. Cross streets at corners only.
This is WNBC FM New York, 97.1 on your FM dial.